no expression. Hide my head, I wanna drown my sorrow. No tomorrow, no tomorrow.
Hi everybody, we're live.
Marco, we've covered this in the show before, but hi, it's me and I have no memory. You are using, I almost said iTunes, you're using the music app as your playback app of choice, is that correct?
That makes it sound like I like it more than I do.
Fair.
Yes, I am using it to play music.
All right, here's what I need from you. I need you and me, and I think we probably have some mutual friends that would be interested as well. And even though this is a terrible idea, it would be an amazing idea. I need you and me and maybe others to work on I guess it would kind of be vaguely similar to a classical music app, but an app for people who are just binging the same like five artists nonstop forevermore. And there's 800 albums per artist.
Believe this is part of the Jams app. I'm telling you, you
need to do it.
So here's the thing with the Jams app. So this is an app that I intend to make probably with the help of AI at some point. It's one of those apps that, like, it would never be worth the time to code the whole thing from scratch without something like AI helping. Because, again, like, as we've talked about before, like, the market for an app that caters to Jamban users and Jamban users who buy a bunch of the downloaded music and Jamban users who buy a bunch of the downloaded music and also want an app like this, we're talking five people. Like, every one of those just, like, it strips it down and down and down further. And the thing is, like, there are other music listening apps out there. And even, like, the Jam Band crowd, there's a lot of overlap between, like, the audiophile / like power user of music crowd and Jam Band listeners. So there are already apps. I think, is this one called Rune, I think, is one of them. There's apps that, like, specialize in things like, you know, high bit rate or, you know, high sample rate, lossless playback and going to, like, fancy DACs and DSD and stuff like that. Like, there's all these, like, high-end audiophile formats and apps that specialize in catering to those formats. That world already exists. And we wouldn't be anybody who wants that world, we wouldn't satisfy their desire. Nope. And so, like, we're going to rule out people who don't care about jam bands. We're going to rule out people who don't buy all the jam band recordings or otherwise acquire them, like people who just want streaming. We're going to rule out people among who's left. We're going to rule out people who actually want, like, those, like, high end, you know, high bit rate audiophile, high fidelity, you know, kind of things. And then we're going to limit it just to people who are on Apple's platforms because, you know, screw that. And then also, it's going to be like people who like our choices and our taste. And so I think it would be a very small market, which is why it is probably worth doing it with AI, but probably not any other way.
Well, the reason I bring this up, as you well know, but our listeners may not, is that it is currently goose season, and I believe you had told me before the show that fish season is coming soon.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a really great service called Nugs, N-U-G-S, that will let you stream or purchase. I guess you can only stream from Nugs, actually, but it will let you stream.
I think you can buy downloads.
Maybe you can, but one way or another, you can certainly stream concerts in some cases as they're being aired. Like, I could be watching Goose right now, but I'm talking to you two numbnuts. And so anyways, you know, as I'm amassing more and more Goose shows as each passing day goes on, I am finding myself more and more in want of a bespoke solution to manage all of this. And so maybe I can convince you to let me work with you on the Jams app or something. I don't know. What is the maximum amount you can charge for an app? Is it $1,000? If we get, I don't know, 100 people at $1,000, that math might almost work out, maybe.
But none of them would pay $1,000 for our app.
Well, based on Marco's description, I feel like you left out the last part, which is that it turns out Marco's taste is different than Casey's taste. And so now you have to make your own separate vibe code. Right. So now you really have an audience of one for each app.
And we'd be competing for the search keywords, you know, for all six people who would ever search for it.
You know, I am mostly snarking and mostly joking. However, I will say the thought of you and me in any capacity working on some sort of, like, actual development project together, I think would be a beautiful disaster and would make incredible material for the show. So I'll just put that out there.
Would it be good for our friendship, though?
No, not at all. Not even a little bit. It would be so bad. I was thinking recently that somehow this show has been going on, 13 years, and I'm still dear friends with the two of you idiots, and yet I think 13 days of Marco and I working on this together, it would be the end of everything.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, there are certain, you know, certain friendships that can be ruined by, say, becoming roommates, or friendships that can be ruined by becoming romantic partners. I think our friendships between the three of us would be ruined with, like, shared coding projects.
I mean, in your defense, our defense, and someone's defense, maybe John's defense, he's done a lot of work in your PHP, my friend.
Yeah, because he took it over. Because, like, if he and I were working together, he would have killed me, like, 2 years ago.
That's or vice versa, because, yeah.
Just... Probably that direction, though. Probably you would kill me.
I mean, it's true.
I can tell you, you probably have a lot more opinions about PHP than I do. I just want to get the hell out of there most of the time.
So does Marco? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. All right. Before we derail this entire episode, let me tell you, the listeners, about a couple of fun things we have going on. First of all, I'm going to do this in reverse order, which John's going to yell at me for. We have a new member special. ATP Dev Nuggets of Wisdom. This was suggested to us by at least one of
different from Nugs of Wisdom.
Speaking of Nugs.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
It might be a different root meaning there.
Hmm. Yeah, also fair. I didn't even consider that. Nuggets Wisdom.
Really?
So John,
wait, you didn't get that?
No, I didn't.
Why a jam band site would be called Nugs?
No, never even crossed my mind. Because I was never in that scene, in no small part because I think if I ever, ever, ever tried it for more than a second, I would never stop. And so ignorance is bliss, my friend. Anyways, John, tell us about the ATP Dev Nugs/Nuggets of Wisdom.
Yeah, it's just what it says. As usual, we went in kind of blind on this one because this is the first episode like this that we've done. We are all developers, and most of our development history is in the days before LLM, so we have a lot of things that we've learned over the course of writing all the code that we've written, and figured we would do a member special with, tips and tricks or, you know, lessons or, and, you know, nuggets of wisdom. And my idea was to come in with, things that we've learned and that no idea was too small. And that even that instruction turned out to have many loopholes. So you'll see how it went. There are nuggets and it is some wisdom. And if people like it, you know, if people like this episode, we'll probably do another one because we didn't get through all of our lists and there's surely more that we can add. And even now we're getting follow up on it and everything. So if you are a developer, for sure, check this out, especially if you want to hear from a bunch of old people who are developers. And if you're not a developer, maybe you'll learn something about development or just hear us yell at each other. So, yeah, there you go. ATP Dev Nuggets of Wisdom.
Yeah,
all
it
right.
was fun.
Thank you, John. It was fun. And yes, it's very small, has very different definitions between the three of us. And then we will make our repeat plea for the ATP store. You can find that at atp.fm/store. If you are in line for coffee, if you are walking the streets of Manhattan, if you're driving, pull over, step out of line, do whatever you need to do, and go to atp.fm/store and get yourself some sweet, sweet ATP merch. John, would you like me to do the nickel tour or would you like to?
I will do it. I just want to remind everybody the sale ends Sunday, April 26th. This is the second of three shows that we will talk about it on. Just do it now, because but if you don't listen to the third show immediately, by the time you hear it, the sale will be over. So this is it. This is actually when you should, if you're going to want something in the store, get it now. What we've got is we've got our ATP Neo shirts, which are in the colors of the MacBook Neo, which we'll talk about more in a little bit. We've got a Mac Pro Memorial shirt, which is just like the Mac Pro Believe shirt, but instead of saying Believe, it has birth date and year date on the bottom. It's very sad. Wear it to make Apple executives guilty. We've got the T568A crossover and B crossover shirts, which are like the T568A and B Ethernet wiring shirts that we sold in a past sale, only now they're the fully crossed crossover cable for both of those standards, making the colors even more mixed up.
I love those
even
so much.
Even nerdier than before, even harder to explain to people when you wear it. we have, of course, the M5 Pro and M5 Max shirts. People ask, did you ever sell a plain M5 shirt? Yeah, we did when the plain M5 was out. And then people are like, oh, but I want to get the plain M5 one now. Well, here's the thing. We sell these CPU shirts when the CPU, like whatever the sale is after the CPUs came out. And then we tend not to sell them again, except for the on-demand ones, which you don't want those. They're not as good, although they are cheaper. But anyway, someone's like, oh, I just got an M4 Max. Where can I get an M4 Max shirt? I always say this. It's like the old cliche of, you know, dress for the job you want. Buy the shirt with the chip that you want, not the one you have. Aspirational. These are aspirational shirts. Maybe you don't have an M5 Max. Maybe someday you think you're going to own one. Get the shirt now because we won't sell it again. So M5 Pro and M5 Max shirts. We like to bring back an old shirt. This time we brought back ATP Pixels, a very popular shirt, which is the colorful ATP logo rendered in extremely non-retina pixels, big chunky pixels that were very difficult to print, but we figured out a way to do it. That's very cool.
Yeah, the Pixel shirt, by the way, I think among all the like regular-ish ATP shirts we've ever made, the Pixel shirt might be one of the nicest. It's a really, like, I really enjoy the complexity of the pattern, like the implementation details of it. It's a very nice shirt. That's part of why it has almost no profit margin, because it has very expensive printing methods to get all the sharp pixels and all the different colors. But it is worth it. Like, if you just want a fun, nerdy ATP shirt, that's a good one to get.
And fun fact, I made all those little squares. Oh, it's like one of those things where, because I'm not a graphic designer, I have no idea how to use the tools. So I'm like, well, I can brute force this. And I did. They're all little squares. It's ridiculous. It's terrible. Someone who knows how to do this would look at the file and say, why didn't you just do X, Y, and Z and just automatically cut up your pattern into squares? It's like, I don't know how. But anyway, they're squares. We've got a regular ATP shirt, our hoodie, our polo shirt, which we sell in the warmer weather. It's got a collar on it, an embroidered ATP logo, and of course our hat. One other thing people are asking about, how the Neo sales, the colors are doing, because we have like a indigo, blush, citrus, and silver to match the MacBook Neo colors. I don't know if either one of you guessed, seen it. If you've looked at the sales figures, don't say anything. But you haven't looked at the sales figure. What is your prediction for like ratios of the colors that are available?
All right, I have not looked at the sales figures. I'm going to guess the blue one outsells the number two one. I'm guessing blue is number one, and then it outsells the whatever's number two, 2-1. And number two, I would guess, probably is the lemon color one.
Citrus, please. Casey, you got anything?
So I didn't see numbers. However, I will say that we get emails once we've crossed the threshold of, oh, this will be printed by Cotton Bureau. And I feel like the Neo one came in just lickety-split. So
yeah,
clearly...
Mark would have seen that email too, so it's kind of cheating.
Yeah,
oh, I don't
read
those
emails. Yeah, see, it's all right.
Now that the emails go to all three of us, I just archive everything from Cotton Bureau.
Yeah, that's fine.
So I knew that the Neo was selling the best. I would say, I think Marco just said this as well, by a factor of 2, maybe even 3-1 would be my guess, because I haven't seen numbers. I just know that it
Wait, are you talking
quickest.
About Neo versus the other shirts or the colors within Neo?
I'm sorry.
I was talking about the colors within Neo.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Indigo, blush, citrus, and silver. Those are your four choices.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. I misspoke. I think indigo is probably 2, maybe even 3x over the others. I would say Neo's probably second. God, I did it again. I would say citrus is probably second.
Yeah, I'd say pink number three.
Silver, I would think silver's third and blush is fourth.
I'm kind of surprised that you two didn't make the prediction I thought you would make, which is that... you know, the sort of stereotypical, like when someone who is like us is buying an iPhone or something, we just get the gray one or the black one, right?
Like sort of. Well, but I figured like if you're gonna have like if one of these colors was just black, I think that would outsell by a pretty
good
margin.
Like is indigo your stand in for that?
Yeah, in the same way like with the iPhone 17 that they made like the dark blue one for people who really want like just the boring gray or black one.
Yeah. Anyway, as you know, with these sales where we take a bunch of orders and then they print the shirts, you have to order a certain number of them before they print the shirts. And what Casey was talking about is when we cross the threshold of like, now enough people have ordered this that we're actually going to print it. We get an email when that happens. And so that's where he was getting that info from. And I can tell you the number required to print one of these shirts is not high. It's 12. 12 people need to buy a shirt for it to get printed. If fewer than 12 people buy the shirt or pre-order the shirt, they'll just get their money refunded and the shirt will not be printed because it's not worth the time for the printing company to do that because of the scale of things. Here's the thing. Indigo is the most popular, as Casey noted, because that email came first. And they're not that distant from each other. The second place is citrus, and it is, I don't think it's double, but it's, you know, it's a pretty big gap. All right. But here is the shocker. We are a week into the sale. You know how many silver shirts we've sold?
I'm going to say
one.
Like, oh, wow.
One.
Holy jamolies.
We have sold one silver shirt. Nobody wants that. I mean, granted, it is the color that is the least accurate to the laptop. So that's true. I said it in the description, I think, when I was posting, tooting about it or whatever, that it's, I felt like it was more important to get the same shirt from the same manufacturer for all the colors rather than having one be an entirely different shirt. And this is the best gray that they had to match the silver one. But it's also very neutral and plain and kind of grayscale. So I'm like, yeah, maybe people will pick it just because they don't want a brightly colored shirt. Indigo is the most popular, and indigo, blush, and citrus course, are all going to be printed because more than 12 people have ordered them, although sometimes not much more than 12. Silver, one shirt. So whoever, if you're out there and you ordered ATP Neo in silver, you're not going to get your shirt unless 11 other people buy that shirt. I'm not encouraging people to buy it because, hey, if you don't want a gray shirt, don't get the gray shirt. But I'm just warning that one person who ordered the silver shirt, it's not looking good for you. Maybe change your order to indigo. It's very popular.
This is the service we provide. Not really. But yes.
And yeah, reminder that ATP members get 15% off. So if you are a member, go to your member page to get your discount code for 15% off. If you're not a member, it's worthwhile for you to sign up and get 15% off because you can make up the cost of 1 month of membership easily by ordering a couple of things. So there you go.
And but you don't have to cancel after the month is over, just to put it out there. You have a lot of specials like ATP Dev Nuggets of Wisdom that you can check out as well. All right, let's do some follow-up. First of all, Marco made what I presume was just an off-the-cuff judgment call, which, given the information you had, made perfect sense. And, oh boy, did we get feedback about it.
Yeah.
So, Marco, would you like to handle this?
Yeah, so when I was talking about, in the after show, I was talking about the Suunto watch I was trying as it compared to Garmin watches for sports and fitness watches. And I referred to Suunto as a young or as a new company, which I think was generally accurate for their presence in the sport watch market relative to Garmin, I think. However, everyone wrote in to tell me that Suunto it was actually founded in 1936. They made like compasses at first and then dive computers later. And you know, so eventually like they did get to the modern smartwatch. But the actual company itself is like 100 years old. So whoops. But I think that's I think I can be forgiven for describing it as being relatively young to the fitness watch market relative to Garmin, because I think that is almost certainly the case. We do have some specifics that were written in.
Yes, so Henry Sividen writes, on last episode, Marco referred to Suunto as a younger company relative to Garmin. According to the Finnish language Wikipedia, Suunto was founded in 1936, making it 53 years older than Garmin. Suunto started making dive computers in the 80s. The first PC connectivity for those was in the early 90s. And Suunto introduced a wrist computer in 2004. We'll put a link to English language Wikipedia in the show notes. And then Fugu writes, the only thing Suunto seems to have done later than Garmin is to release a GPS watch in 2012. The Garmin watch from 2003 already had GPS. However, it's quite possible that the current Suunto software stack is much younger than Garmin's, which seems to be much more fragmented. All right. Last episode, we were talking about color spaces, and we were gushing about Eric Portis's really great webpage about that, which is linked in the prior show notes. We were talking about Bartosz Szymanowski's, hopefully I got that close, and basically everything that he has ever done is incredible. And John, you had made an off the cuff comment about how there was a really good thing that you had seen recently that you probably couldn't put your finger on. Well, Ben Landsberg figured it out. This is what both John and myself were thinking of. It's ASCII characters are not pixels, a deep dive into ASCII rendering by Alex Hari, which we'll put a link to that in the show notes for sure. And if I remember, I'll put the other links back in as well.
Yeah, that's less of an explainer, more of like I was doing this software project and here's how I progressed through the project. It's really fun. Again, with lots of interactive examples and explaining like the reasoning and the different things that Alex tried to do this somewhat fanciful and whimsical thing that he's doing, which is basically like, can you render things using only ASCII characters, which is something that you're very familiar with if you're a Unix nerd from way back, but people are still doing it.
All right. Is Apple running low on the Bind 18 Pros? Uh-oh. Joe Rossignol from Mac Rumors writes, the all-new MacBook Neo has been such a hit that Apple is facing a, quote, massive dilemma, quote, according to Taiwan-based columnist and former Bloomberg reporter Tim Kulpan. Kulpan says the MacBook Neo is selling so well that Apple's supply of the Bind 18 Pro chips with a 5-core GPU will run out before the company is able to fully satisfy demand for the laptop. Apple's initial plan was to have suppliers build around 5 to 6 million MacBook Neos before ceasing production of the model with the A18 Pro chip, Kulpan said. But it sounds like demand is so strong that Apple might run out of the A18 Pro chips before the second generation MacBook Neo with an A19 Pro chip is ready next year. A18 Pro chips are manufactured with TSMC's N3E process, and Kolpan said that the N3E production lines are currently operating at maximum capacity. As a result, Apple may have to pay a premium to restart A18 Pro chip production for the MacBook Neo, which would lower its profit margins. Alternatively, Apple could reallocate some of its chip production that was originally planned for other devices, but the cost would still be higher than what Apple paid for its initial batch of A18 Pro chips that were presumably binned. In either case, Apple would have to disable a GPU core in these chips to ensure that they have only a 5-core GPU like all the other MacBook Neo units sold to date.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's the case. So the binned one, this is like a way to, you know, make lemonade out of lemons. So you're making a bunch of A18 Pros. Some of them have a bum GPU. Why don't we just save them? Put those off to the side. Don't throw those away. We might find a use for those, and they use them in the MacBook Neo. So all the ones with the bad GPU core they can use in the MacBook Neo. I don't know if that is the entire source of their A18 Pros, or if they also took a bunch of fully working A18 Pros and disabled one of the GPU cores. But either way, when you buy a MacBook Neo from Apple, you get an A18 Pro. One of the GPU cores is either disabled or didn't work to begin with. Okay, so that's the deal. If they're running out of those chips, yeah, it kind of sucks for them. Now they have to start the manufacturing line and start making more of them, and that costs them money, and they got to take capacity from other things and all that other stuff, and it lowers their margins. But they could also just say, okay, well, when we start up the line now, we'll take all the ones that have all the working GPU cores, and then just update the Neo spec to say now when you buy a MacBook Neo, it's like a Rev, you know, not a Rev 2 or whatever, but like a second version of it, where now all the GPU cores work. It just seems like a waste to take a perfectly working six GPU core thing and disable one of them. And people are like, well, you can't do that because then the people who bought the first one with the core that didn't work, they're going to be mad. It's like it happens all the time. Apple releases a new revision of a product that has some spec slightly better. That's life. You buy the product you buy, and if in the future a slightly better version of that product comes out, you can't say, but I bought one last year and it only had 5 GPU cores, and now you're selling it for the same price with 6. Well, that's technology for you. So they could do that, or they could pull forward the A19 Pro product or whatever. So all I can say is this is a good problem to have. They made a product that everybody loves. Yeah. It's selling like hotcakes, so much so that even their probably very accurate, usually very accurate planning underestimated the demand. You'd rather have this than the opposite problem, which is you buy a HomePod on its last day for sale, and it turns out it was manufactured 3 years ago, and those are all the HomePods they ever manufactured.
Yeah, I think, though, like, you know, in this case, you know, if they do have to make more A18 Pros, and, like, yeah, if they have to, they will. They'll work it out with TSMC, and, yeah, they might eat a little bit of margin, but they'll work it out. I think whether they, like, you know, hardware disable one of the GPUs, even if it would have worked, or whether they do this kind of, you know, quieter revision where they just all of a sudden now they have six core GPUs, I don't think it really matters either way, because the reality is that for the kinds of things that people are doing on these chips, the difference of that one GPU core is not a huge difference. We're not talking about, like, it'd be different if, like, you know, the number of you know, P cores on the CPU was cut in half. That's not the case here. Like, this is 5 of 6 GPUs or 6 of 6 GPUs. They scale almost perfectly proportionally, so you can figure out the, you know, the math on that. You know, what is that, like a 16% drop in, or difference in performance? It's not a huge difference here. So I think in reality, whichever one of these they do, it shouldn't and probably won't be like a big deal to basically anybody.
The one thing they can't do, or the one thing they probably shouldn't do is manufacture a bunch of new ones and then just put them into the Neos, whether they have 5 or 6, because then you don't know what you're going to get. And that, you know, people are always waiting to, you know, file class action lawsuits against Apple, right? So if you decide that you're going to do the 6, then they all have to have 6, and you need to update it on your spec page and say it's a new revision of the MacBook Neo. They all have 6 now, right? Because that's no one can really sue you about that. You just made a better version of a product later. But if you don't update the specs at all, but some of them have 6 and some of them have 5, I don't know if it would be a valid lawsuit, but I can almost guarantee you somebody would sue and say, oh, I paid the same price as this person, and they got 6 and I got 5, and the spec page says 5, doesn't say anything about 6. What's the deal, Apple? Someone would definitely sue over that. Again, I don't know if they would win or if that is even remotely valid, but people love to sue Apple over stuff like that, so that's the only path they really can't take. Any other path is open to them, including disabling the working ones or just selling all of them as 6-core.
Yeah, like I'm guessing they would actually just disable the working one to make it 5, because I think that is the less problematic version of that. And there's a lot of precedent for that in the chip business.
Well, like, you wouldn't waste the ones with only five then, because if you disable the other ones, then you can use every chip. Well, not every chip. Every chip with five or six you can use. But if you only use the six ones, the ones with five, like, what are you going to save them for? Is there going to be another product that's going to want a five GPU?
No, I'm saying, like, I think the best course of action, if they need to manufacture more A18 Pros, I think the best course of action is basically lock them all to five GPUs. And continue to have the product be described and performing the same way. And there is a lot of precedent for that. Like back in the old days, there were all these hacks about like overclocking certain Celerons, because I believe Intel had a kind of a similar-ish issue where like they were selling the Celeron as like their discount chip, but their manufacturing at that time was pretty good, and so they didn't really have enough like crappy low performing. Stuff or whatever it was, like their production was so good that they had to basically like soft limit the chips just to make enough of them to sell. And your luck in overclocking the chip was kind of in part due to just like however good yours happened to be above the spec they were actually selling it at.
I bet they got sued by somebody about that too.
I doubt it, but because, like, you know,
no, people can sue for anything. You know, I'm not saying they won the case, but, like, that's the type of thing that someone would sue over and say, it shouldn't be a random lottery, you know?
Yeah, but it performed to what they advertised it as.
Yeah, I know. I'm not saying they won the lawsuit. I'm just saying that's exactly the type of thing people sue about.
All right. With regard to Apple IDs and passkeys, Vitor writes, the situation is even more bananas than you described last episode. Apple added a passkey to my account without my consent with my original Apple ID email. I've since changed that email, but every time I need to log in, they still push me to do so with the passkey associated with the old email. There's no way to remove or update that passkey. I'm not alone with this problem, and we'll put in one link to Reddit, the Apple Help subreddit, and a second link, in this case, to the passkey subreddit, where Apple claims, or so claims somebody on Reddit, that the fix would be made soon, 2 years ago. Whoops.
Yeah, I don't quite understand the problem here, but clearly it is a real problem of like Apple creating passkeys for you, but they're like everything else having to do with Apple IDs or Apple accounts, that it's not normal. It's its own special unique snowflake that works differently than all the other stuff. So I guess it won't show up in the passwords app. And again, surprise, Apple implemented a supposed, you know, sort of quality of life convenience feature where now you can change your Apple ID email. I bet that won't cause any problems. Just like transferring purchases and all the other things they do that they seem like a good idea until you actually try to use it and it turns out, you know, oh well, I used that feature where you could change your Apple ID email and now you're forever prompting me for a passkey I no longer have access to, apparently. So yeah, that whole system is so creaky. Talk about, you know, again, making a John Turner's to-do list or whatever. It's like, geez, just there's so many parts of Apple that have not faced any competition in so long and they have not gotten any better that are just filled with garbage, and the Apple ID system is one of those.
Oh yeah, especially around passkeys, around developer account being separate, like all of those conditions. And it's funny because, like, you know, the developer account issue is like, this is like every Apple developer hits this issue, and the login process for a developer is so awkward because you have to first like hit cancel, no, I don't want to use my passkey for my personal Apple ID, and then log in for the developer, use the password, and then if it prompts you for 2FA, then you have to, even if the machine that you're on is trusted, it will put up the dialog box with the six-digit code, and the input box on the website that you're logging into is centered perfectly in the middle of the browser window. Well, then the six-digit code dialog box is centered in the middle of the screen. So it covers up. If your browser window is centered on your screen, then the code that pops up covers up where you have to enter it. So you have to drag the code window off to the side a little bit to be able to then re-access on the page the six-digit code so you can type it in, which it went on autofill. Like, it's the worst experience. Like, Apple has made logins so much nicer for everyone else except Apple. It's very, very weird.
And you're forgetting my favorite game, which now I find myself doing unconsciously, which is, you know, when it sends me the little, you know, Apple ID login thing that shows the map, it'll send it to my phone or whatever. And it'll say, you know, allow, deny, and it shows the little map. I'm like, yeah, that's me. I hit allow. After hitting allow, it then shows the six digits. But sometimes, as I've complained about in the past, sometimes it will show the six digits for a fraction of a second before they disappear. Mm-hmm. So now when I hit that allow, I prime my brain to memorize the six digits as they flash on the screen. because sometimes, as I've said when I was setting things up, sometimes there's just no way to do it. Like, it will never stay, you know, unless like, it comes up on my phone, I hit allowed, 6 digits appear, and they immediately disappear. And I have to memorize them in that fraction of a second that they appear, so I get good at it. It's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Oy. Hello, Future Marco.
Hi.
John, we're half an hour in. No snark. I'm not trying to be a turd. Do you want to do this next topic, or do you want to save it?
I think we have time for the Stealing TV one, because it's mostly, I don't think there's a lot of commentary. I think it's just info.
Just want
to
make sure.
We've done a good job of it being expedient and getting to this point with only 30 minutes in.
Go team. Go us. Look at us. Who would have thought? All right. Goodbye, Future Marco. All right. And then finally for tonight, some updates with regard to stealing television. This is the overtime discussion we had in 679 about the Super Box and the other ways that people are stealing TV. And Nye Hughes writes, this reminded me of a Guardian article that suggests, in the UK at least, modded Amazon Fire TV sticks are being used to log keystrokes and passwords to enable fraud. A recent survey, this is from the article, a recent survey from BeStreamWise, a UK initiative established to counter the problem, found 2 out of every 5 people who used illegal streaming were defrauded. They lost an average of almost £1,700 each as a result. Whoopsie-dipsies. The potential for fraud happens the minute you connect the dodgy stick, or so it's called, to a laptop or a TV, according to Rob Shapland of Psionic Cyber. Quote, alongside the stream of TV or sports, will also install some malware onto your computer and give the criminal direct access to your computer so that they can use it as if they were sitting there, he claims, says, whatever. Quote, or they can install keyloggers, which will record any password you are typing. So when you're accessing online banking, it will record your banking passwords. You are essentially volunteering to have your laptop hacked in many cases. Whoopsie-dipsies. And then additionally, there was a Krebs on Security article where Brian Krebs writes, Ashley, an engineer at Sensis, a cyber intelligence company, found that the Superbox devices immediately contacted a server at the Chinese instant messaging service Tencent QQ, as well as a residential proxy service called Grass.io. Also known as getgrass.io, Grass says it is a decentralized network that allows users to earn rewards by sharing their unused internet bandwidth with AI labs and other companies. Quote, buyers seek unused internet bandwidth to access a more diverse range of IP addresses, which enables them to see certain websites from a retail's perspective, the Grass website explains. By utilizing your unused internet bandwidth, they can conduct market research or perform tasks like web scraping to train AI.
I would just love to meet that. I think the person who wrote this copy did such a good job, because it's like, okay, here's what we're doing. We need to appear to be legitimate people, so we're going to commandeer legitimate people's internet connections, so basically we'll be indistinguishable from legitimate people. Basically, we want to turn people into a giant botnet we can control. All right, now you write copy for that and make it sound not nefarious. Right? They right. want to access a more diverse range of IP addresses, which enables them to see certain websites from a retail perspective.
Mm.
They did it. They did it. You made it not sound terrible, but it is. It's really terrible.
It sure is. So finally, from Krebs on Security, it may be that many Superbox customers don't care if someone uses their internet connection to tunnel traffic for ad fraud and account takeovers.
Oh, I forgot about ad fraud. Yeah, making it seem like people are clicking on ad banners. They're coming from legit IP addresses.
For them, it beats paying for multiple streaming services each month. My guess, however, is that quite a few people who buy or are gifted these products have little understanding of the bargain they're making when they plug them into an internet router. Some of the other, I didn't pull the quotes, but some other sections of the same article, I believe it was the Krebs article, talk about how they use some sort of hack. I'm outside my comfort zone, but basically they force a device that's already on your local network to like crash or what have you. Again, my terminology is wrong. And they will then slurp up that IP address so it looks even more legitimate to your own network. Like, it's crazy some of the shenanigans these things do. Basically, do not touch. And then finally, with regard to this, David Brownman writes, the Darknet Diaries podcast did a pretty detailed episode on the cybersecurity side of the Superbox, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, so we did touch on this in the overtime, that there's, you know, lots of these boxes are shady and people claim that the software on them is hacking people or whatever, but this is like a concrete study from the UK saying that people are getting their money stolen for real, like in measurable large amounts by using these products. And you know, the attraction of getting TV for free is apparently enough to keep people coming back, but they're bad news.
Indeed. All right, let's talk topics. And maybe I should have poured a drink for this episode, because we got to talk about ads and Apple Maps, baby. For real this time. So Emma Roth at The Verge wrote, I don't know, I think a few weeks ago as we record this, Apple will soon allow businesses to buy advertisements in its Maps app. In an announcement on Tuesday, Apple says ads may appear at the top of your search results in Maps, as well as in a new suggested places list. They will arrive in-app in the U.S. and Canada this summer. Marco, if you wouldn't mind, would you prepare your bleep gun? Because this is such fucking beep. Bullshit, and beep. I hate it so much. I haven't even seen it. I hate it. Oh, it makes me so mad. It makes me so mad because I, and I think many like me, came to Apple because we were so used to getting PCs filled with bullshit malware, beep. Just overflowing with it everywhere.
Oh, by the way, on that topic, I know this is not in the notes of this week, and maybe we'll talk about it next week, but there was a recent interview that Jaws and Turnus did with Tom's Hardware, and they were fielding a bunch of softball questions about, like, what's great about Apple products or whatever. and they went through everything that's great about it, but then they were on to the next question, and ATP style, one of them, I forget who it was, says, oh, yeah, and also, don't forget, Macs aren't loaded up with bloatware. That was their point, that, like, unlike the competing PC products, the products that compete with the MacBook Neo, when you get a Mac, it's not filled with, like, you know, like you said, a bunch of crappy software that you don't want that's showing a bunch of stuff in your face. And I felt like reaching through the YouTube screen and saying, but it is. Increasingly, it is.
Yeah. Have you seen the defaults bottom bar with the dock? God, I just had my blue screen.
Obviously, when it's Jeezy, Apple stuff, that's not an ad. That's Apple stuff.
No, I know exactly. But like the
try
default,
the new version of Pages,
right?
So I actually have seen the default so dock because when I was setting up 48 Mac Minis without doing any kind of MDM, one of my steps was taking all of those out one by one. Whoosh, whoosh, yep. Whoosh.
You can automate that by just changing the plist.
Well, I didn't know that at the time, and I didn't want to ask you because then it would spoil the bit. So I did it.
Ask ChatGPT.
For 48 Mac Minis, one of my setup steps was dragging out all, like, you know, 15 of the dock icons out of the dock.
Did you get really good at figuring out where the remove thing appears?
Yeah, because it's not, you have to go up a little bit. Like, you know, it can't just be like, you know, the first pixel. You got to go up like, you know, 200 pixels.
Remember when I used to have the poof?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and those it still makes the same sound.
Yeah.
And that's just...
Anyway, sorry to derail you, Casey.
No.
Not filled with bloatware.
I'm not sorry.
So, anyways, you know, so many of us, and I think especially those of us who had grown up with PCs, like Marco, like me, came to Apple because, especially circa, you know, mid-2000s, my recollection, maybe I'm just looking with rose-colored glasses, but my recollection was I had been using PCs for so long. They were utter crap. They were crap in ways that I knew and crap in ways that I didn't even understand yet. And they were crap. And then finally, and John, I mean, the timeline may not be exactly right, but the way I recall it is that it was around the mid-aughts that Mac OS X was really starting to get its junk together. Now, you could argue it was great from the beginning, but it was like properly good at this point. And so I moved to the Mac, and I think it was 2008, if I'm not mistaken, maybe it was 2007. No, it was 2007. And it was such a breath of fresh air. Everything worked. It was intuitive. It was beautiful. There was no garbage. I didn't have to put my wrist on an Intel Inside sticker for the rest of time and just watch it peel away slowly but surely. And everything was so amazing and so wonderful. And I feel like in the last 5, maybe 10 years in particular, all of that goodness has gone away in various different ways. Software isn't as stable as it was. The Apple software isn't as stable as it was. And it does so many things. And I think Apple is spread so thin that they lose track of things, like we were just lamenting a moment ago, like Apple IDs. But I feel like the software has been spread so thin. There's so many edge cases that Apple no longer conquers. Now, in the defense of Apple, it's also gotten way more complicated, which is hard. It's very hard. But it doesn't just work anymore. And that bums me out. Additionally, the search for ever more money and ever more services revenue means that instead of just being a company that makes their money off of hardware, now they have to make their money off of recurring revenue from me paying them for things that sometimes I think, yes, they deserve money for this. And sometimes I'm like, what is going on here? For example, iCloud storage. I should probably pay them for some amount of iCloud storage, but should that iCloud storage still be 5 gigabytes in the year 2026? I think not. And it's just frustrating that this is yet another example of things just getting ickier and getting more Windows-like. And honestly, I haven't used Windows in over a decade. And it is, I genuinely wonder at this point, is Windows less garbaged up?
No, Windows is getting worse. They're putting ants in start.
It's not less garbage. Oh, okay. Yeah. So,
all right. Well, that makes me feel a little bit better.
And this is part of the shame of it. And this is kind of part of what I was hoping, what I was trying to get at with my letter to John Turner's blog post. Like, part of the shame here is like Apple is getting significantly worse in certain ways in areas that are very important to us, but no one else is getting better at it. Like, it's not like Windows is amazing at this. You know,
yeah, Windows is worse than it's ever been at this, arguably.
Yeah. Industry-wide, there is a slow process of I won't use Cory Doctorow's word necessarily because I don't think it quite fits here, but, like, there's a slow process of just erosion of respect for users' time, attention, and resources.
Motivated by the possibility of making more money.
Right. And if it's the reality is, like, in many industries, their margins get super squeezed and they get desperate. And they start doing things that are crappy because they kind of have to make any money at all. And the really sad thing is that's always been Apple's competitors. That's never been Apple's situation. Apple, I mean, not never, but, you know, certainly not in the modern era. Apple's modern era is they have more money than they know what to do with. They don't need to become desperate to find ways to make 0.5% more money. They can just make better products. We were just talking about the MacBook Neo doing really well, like blowing away expectations because they made a really good product and people like it. It fits the market well. It's there at a good time. You know, the opportunity to take market share from PCs right now is really huge for lots of reasons. And so what a great product. Look at the success of the iPhone 17 Pro. They made the cool orange one, and it's a great product. They had this cool color that did the marketing for them largely. And then they made this amazing Pro phone that took what we wanted about iPhones and removed certain pain points, made things better. Like, it's just the iPhone 17 Pro is an amazing product. Look at the modern Macs. The modern Macs, beyond just the Neo, they're amazing. They're so amazing you can't even buy the desktops anymore right now because they're all sold out. Like, the modern Mac lineup is so good. There is not a single bad laptop that Apple sells anymore. And that's what a thing to be able to say after, you know, some of the kind of mid 2010s kind of years there got kind of bad. But what an amazing state the products are in. And they can make more money by expanding the market of those products or by making people upgrade when they're compelling upgrades. And they do. That is still how they make most of their money. They can even have this whole thing called services, even though what services makes most of us money from is rents. And, you know, but we'll put that aside for this particular part of this discussion. You know, services makes tons of money based on delivering additional revenue sources to their products, most of which don't annoy or badger or harass their users. Most. And then they started selling ads. First in the App Store, and, you know, now coming to Maps. And there's a few things about this that irritate me greatly. Number one, it's just not that much money relative to the services category.
Like, especially since Apple's really bad at selling ads against anything.
Well, see, that's the second part that annoys
me. What is the potential upside for Apple? Not what is the potential upside for Google, because Apple's not Google.
Yeah, the second part of this that annoys me is that I have been an Apple Search Ads customer since Search Ads launched. I just paused my Search Ad campaign for the first time in years, just about a month ago, because I'm mad at them. But the Apple Search Ads product is awful. Like, the only thing holding it up as being anything that is worth anyone ever spending money on is that there are still a lot of people in the App Store searching for things, and now they've created this awful situation for all of us, which is if you don't buy, like, your own name and your own keywords, everyone else will buy them, and you will have to fight. And now you have to pay Apple extra just to get to your own customers that you were already going to get before. And and they're still taking their 30%, of course, of all your in-app purchases and stuff. So it feels a lot like double dipping. It's a crappy ads product, and it makes the App Store worse for everybody except Apple. Apple makes a little bit more money from that. Great. Good job. Everything else is worse. It's worse for customers. It's worse for most developers. And it's mostly just a way for big companies to pour a bit more money into Apple's pocket with high bids on keywords. And now they're bringing that same benefit to maps. Great. And it's just it's annoying that it's like adding ads in places like this to make reasonably small amounts of additional revenue sells out the user experience a
yes.
little bit. It
yes.
it sells it out because what Apple's do, you know, what their actions say here is it matters less to us to have a great high-end premium user experience. We would rather make 1% more money. That's what this says. And they have seemingly run out of ideas to make 1% more money in other ways, I guess, or they just don't care. And this is like the hallmark of the Tim Cook era is like product direction by numbers. And there's a place for numbers. Apple certainly has lots of places they use numbers to great success. You know, there's a place for...
Try the new version of numbers.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's a whole other... Don't even get me started on that. Oh, I'm so mad about that. But that's actually a similar problem here. It's like Apple, nothing is sacred to them anymore in the user experience. They are willing to put promos, which are ads, and actual ads all over their products now. There is no more premium experience with Apple products because now it's all full of ads. Because what are you going to do? Where are you going to go? There's nowhere else. So they can now make 1% more money from you. Old Apple wouldn't have done that. You know, I don't like to invoke Steve Jobs that often. I know there were a couple of cases where Steve Jobs floated the idea of putting ads in different places, but under previous leadership, Apple would not have been putting ads in the places they're putting ads now, because I think the previous leadership had more appreciation for a premium user experience. And when you start being managed as, you know, just bean counter, only numbers matter and nothing else matters. If this thing can increase numbers by 5%, why wouldn't we do it? Obviously, we must do it because the numbers will go up. That is a pretty rapid path to mediocrity. And that's never been what has made Apple stand out. They have certainly had many mediocre products and services and times in the past, no question. But where Apple succeeds is making nice products with nice experiences. And ads don't have a place in that. And I wish Apple's leadership would realize where their own success comes from.
Like you said before, you were saying, have they run out of other ways to make money? It's not that they've run out of other ideas for incremental revenue or other ideas to innovate. It's that in addition to those ideas, these ideas, which used to get shot down, no longer get shot down. And that is the dysfunction in the organization. Someone in the org is always going to say, hey, we can make more money if we did this that would annoy users slightly. But what are they going to do? Like, that idea will always exist, will always be presented, is always compelling. It's a compelling business case to Apple because you can say, look, I can show you how this will make us more money. It will make us more successful in this way. And what Apple needs to do, and which they're getting less good at doing, is saying, yes, but our brand promises that we don't do crap like that. And long term, mm-hmm. even though your idea will make a little money now, it will erode that brand promise, the value proposition. It will in the long run, it will make us less money. It's the exact opposite of the thing that made Apple successful, which is do the difficult thing that everyone thinks is a dumb idea, because if you do it long enough or hard enough and it makes users happy, you will make more money than them in the long run. And Apple does still fight that. They're not saying yes to every one of those ideas, but they're saying yes to way too many of them. In particular, they're saying yes to like their own internal things. Like, well, this part of the org says we need to, you know, do upsells inside the iWork applications because that's the only way people will pay for this. And we need to do this, and we need to put, you know, like, we need to advertise the, you know, new AppleCare plans inside system settings because I know the people who are writing system settings, they don't care about that, but this part of the org cares about selling AppleCare, and we need a way to sell, okay, hey, we're all Apple here, same team, so let's do it. And that's what they're saying yes to. They're saying yes to, you know, letting themselves advertise their own crap everywhere, which is already terrible. And then in these cases, like search ads and Map Ads are saying, we can get money from third parties here too, because we have all these customers, we have their eyeballs, they're doing something related to maps, they're in the App Store searching. Like you said, Marco, it's a win for Apple, they think, because it's like, look, we annoy the user, and we suck more money from developers, and we annoy the developers. So everything is worse. The only arguable possible user benefit is, if you're searching for an app, you get to see some possible alternatives to that app. Like if it's a really well-known app, you would otherwise never find the alternatives. That is the only benefit I can think of for that for the user. But mostly it's a net negative for everybody. But Apple's like, yeah, but we make more money. So yeah, that's the problem. They keep saying yes to that. And then this, the ads and maps, like I don't even think of all the things they could do, this is that egregious other than the fact that they're going to do a terrible job at it, except for the fact that as far as I know, is this a rumor? I think it's a rumor. I don't know if it was announcement or but it was announcement from Apple. But anyway, we don't know the details. But here's the thing: so you're going to put ads and stuff. At very least, allow people to pay money to make the ads go away. How about the people who are already paying you for, let's say, the Apple One bundle? Because, like, I'm not saying, oh, it's fine, Apple put ads everywhere and just make people pay to get rid of them. But if we have to live in this world, if we're going to have these ads forced on us, like, to Casey's point, if I'm already paying you, like, the maximum amount a person can pay you, like, I buy your most expensive Apple One bundle that you want me to get, I buy all your products or whatever, is there no way that me paying money will make ads go away anyway? I would pay to get rid of search ads in the App Store if I could. I would certainly pay to get rid of ads in Apple Maps, even though I mostly use Google Maps. Like, and I'm not saying, like, obviously, the number of people who are going to pay to make ads go away is tiny. Like, we know, we have a podcast where people pay to make the ads go away. Most people don't. Like, we get that. But, like, just let that's, it's such an easy out for them to continue to be crappy. Like, I'm not saying this is the solution, but hey, Apple, if you want to continue to erode your own value, you would silence more of Casey's cursing if you just at least allowed the relative handful of people who are willing to pay not to see ads to let them do that. They would grumble about it and they would be pissed, but it would make them slightly more quiet than the current case, which is like, no, we don't care how much money you give us. There's no escape from these ads.
Yep. Couldn't agree more. It's just, this is the sort of thing. Now, I'm showing a lot of biases and I'm bringing a lot of my own priors, as Merlin would say, to the table. But I've always found it frustrating that it's, in my mind, I filed it as a West Coast thing, that there are no decisions made. There's only A-B testing. I know I'm being hyperbolic and I know it's not quite that simple, but I feel like everything is A-B tested and everything is about numbers. And at some point, you have to understand that there are things that are unmeasurable and there are things that are just a vibe. And the vibe that I get from Apple these days, and I don't think I'm alone, is that, oh, they're just as shitty as everyone else, except just a teeny bit less. So if Windows is an 11, Apple is an 8 or a 9. But that's still shitty. Beep. That's still shittier Beep. Than it needs to be. And I'm sorry that I don't have more grown-up language, or maybe less grown-up language, to express my feelings, but I'm so frustrated that this is what this is. And there's nowhere else to go. I think that's the other problem. Like,
yeah,
yes, I suppose I could make this the year of Linux on the desktop for me, but I don't want to do that. Nobody really wants to do that. Please
even
don't.
Even NPM throws ads at you now. Not really ads, but like, hey, these projects need funding.
Because
they've got you at the prompt, and how else are you going to discover that the software that you've been using for free forever needs funding? Like, I don't begrudge NPM that, but I'm just saying, like, everybody, the idea has always existed, which is right where the person's using your software, can we put ads there? Someone will always have that idea. The idea is not new. What is the difference now is people who would formerly say, of course, I'm not in my command line Unix utility, I'm going to put an ad. Like, I understand open source needs funding, but this is not the way to do it. But eventually, the generation that grew up in the current environment gets to control open source projects and said, oh, yeah, totally, we should put that into NPM. And so now it's there.
Yeah, and I think, like, what irritates me about Apple doing it, and this is, granted, this is less about maps now. Now I'm talking about the platform, is, like, if inside of an app like Maps, they put ads. Okay, well, we can use different apps. And yeah, I mean, the other ones have ads too, but at least they're better. So, you know, whatever. There's different options for mapping apps. You can make your own mapping app if you really want to. Nobody can really. Anyway, but you know what I mean. But when the system has ads in places that are required to interact with or privileged. Things like the Settings app, having promos for all of Apple's upsells and crap. Things like the App Store, having ads when you are looking to buy to get software in the only way you can get software on your iOS device. There's no way to escape that. So you don't have a choice as a customer. You are locked in and you are forced to see those ads. And this is not like, you know, a severe like human rights issue or anything, but it is Apple kind of mishandling their position of power, abusing the power they have as the platform to make things a little bit crappier under the guise of, well, everyone's doing this, as you were saying, like everyone's doing this. So therefore, we can do it too, and too bad for you if you don't like it. That doesn't
and
make
it totally
it better.
Works. Like to Casey's point about A/B testing, I can guarantee you they sell more AppleCare now that they push it to you in system settings. Like, there's no question about that. That's why you don't let it happen, because you know if you do let it happen, of course it's going to give you a return on investment. Like, it's the one and only system settings, and you get to put ads there, and that will sell more AppleCare. And the people who came up with ideas, see, I told you. And the people who are against the ideas, we were never arguing that it wouldn't work. We were arguing that we shouldn't do it because it erodes the value of Apple as a brand and a company.
And it just – and, like, even if you can't get them to quantify the brand damage, it seems like you also can't get a lot of these higher-ups there now to believe in the promise of just making things because they're better this way. Like, just – like, instead of adding ads somewhere because it makes some number go up, maybe you can have the prestige and self-control – to show some restraint and not take every single opportunity to make a bit more money if it makes the product worse.
That's what I was talking about with the Turnus thing. Like, that if you're Steve Jobs, you say, no, that makes it crappy, I'm not going to do it, and everyone disagrees with you. But if you're John Turnus and you say that, then now you have people saying, well, he turned down this idea that we proved could give you X amount more money in AppleCare subscriptions, and he said no to it for an unquantifiable benefit. We can show you the numbers. This is how much more money we make on AppleCare if we do this. And all they had to say was some mumbo-jumbo about brand value, like, whatever, show me the numbers on that, dummy. And because you're not Steve Jobs and didn't found the company and everybody worships you, that it becomes a ding against you. And like that's what makes people do the wrong thing, because they don't feel secure enough to say we're not doing that because it sucks. Like, and I'm sure sometimes they do. Again, it's not like they're just, you know, bending over and doing every bad idea that exists, but they're, you can, in this battle within Apple, you can see the people who want to junk stuff up are winning more of these fights, and that's the trend. Again, it's the trend line. I would still say it's, you know, Casey said that like Windows is an 11 and Apple is an 8. I think the range is much, much greater. Windows is in a way worse situation. but, like, you know, we're not Windows users, so we don't care. I'm just looking at the trend lines. That's why we're, even though every one of these little things, it seems small and it is small, but, like, the line is going in the wrong direction. And if we just extrapolate, bad things happen.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, Apple does have an area that they are a little bit better at defending, and that's privacy. Privacy, in some ways, I mean, again, it's a little bit different because, you know, when Apple says privacy is a human right, I think that is about as important as it is. I don't think that's hyperbole, and I do think that the right to use your computer without seeing ads is not a human right. But they do things in the name of privacy. Now, granted, not every time they invoke privacy is for good reasons. Many times they will invoke privacy in things like, you know, defenses against monopoly accusations and bad behavior, basically as a BS defense to try to excuse their bad behavior that they're really doing for other reasons. But not every time. Many of the times that Apple invokes privacy are real and genuine and beneficial. And Apple really does care about privacy more than just the numbers alone would, you know, dictate that they should. And that is an area that it's considered a core value to the company. And credit to Tim Cook, that is something he has brought to the table and he cares a lot about. It isn't that Steve Jobs didn't care about privacy, but Tim Cook seems to care a lot more, and I give him credit for that. It is a core value that Apple defends privacy in their product choices, even when it's really difficult most of the time. but under Tim Cook, that same consideration has not been held for the quality of the user experience. And that's an, like, I think that's where, you know, Steve Jobs really did hold that as a high value. The same way Tim Cook values privacy, Steve Jobs valued a premium, nice user experience. And Tim Cook doesn't. And modern Apple doesn't. They happen to have enough people there who are left who still are able to create good user experiences most of the time. But there isn't any pressure in the way that there is so much pressure to preserve privacy at Apple. There is no such pressure to preserve the quality of the user experience. And there really needs to be. Because having all these little ads and promos and little paper cuts everywhere, it just, each one of those is an erosion of quality and an erosion of the premium brand and the experience. And they don't seem to think so. Or at least those people are not able, they're not empowered to defend the quality of the user experience when, oh, but if we ruin this thing a little bit more, we can make a bit more services revenue.
And I think the thing that makes me, one of the things that makes me so exasperated about this is that there's almost no way to put this back away, right? What's the turn of phrase I'm looking for? There's no way
to put the genie back in the bottle. There is a way. You just make different decisions in the future. You can bend this line.
But the thing is,
to do it, but, you know, fingers crossed.
But even still, are they ever going to take away a revenue stream? Really?
Steve Jobs did things like that all the time. See, good CEOs, it's called leadership. You can't just say, oh, I'm never going to do anything that's going to cause any kind of bad result, because there's a long-term benefit. That's called leadership. That's what Apple needs. Good CEOs make decisions like that all the time. It is absolutely possible. Will they do it? I don't know, but I totally believe it. We see it happen all the time. We saw it happen with turning around Apple itself when Steve Jobs came back and did it. He destroyed tons of stuff before things got better.
Well, also, it's not even that much money. Like, relative
to
what
they're... The other thing, it's not like you're saying stop selling the iPhone. I mean, come on, like, you'll be okay.
Like, we're talking about, like, a drop in the bucket, even within the services category, which itself... I mean, granted, the services category is pretty large now as a percentage of their profit, and that's why they keep pushing it.
And it's
it.
The growing one, and the stock market won't like it, and yada, yada. Like, there's a million reasons, but it's not insurmountable.
And it's not that much money. Like, I mean, obviously, in absolute terms, like, it's probably more money than
it's a huge amount of money
us will ever see.
In relative terms.
In relative terms, relative to their services revenue, we're not talking about getting rid of the entire App Store cut and the entire Google search deal and, like, you know, the things that actually make big differences. We're not talking about that. We're talking about drops in the bucket, especially, like, ads and maps. Those are, like, the way Apple handles ad sales and the systems they built and the primitive garbage ranking algorithms they use, those aren't going to be that successful financially, like, because they're not going to be that good. The App Store search ads probably make substantially more money than anything that will ever be made in Maps. And the App Store search ads are also terrible, but at least those are more like, you know, there's more kind of like an intent to buy. There's a lot more search volume, if I had to guess, compared to monetizable maps transactions, like, or map searches. So I think this is going to be, we're talking about crapping up a core system app for not that much money. And that's what makes it even more frustrating, that it's not like they're, like, betting the whole company on some huge thing that's going to turn a huge amount of money over. No, it's not. They're just adding another paper cut to make one of their core apps worse for everyone to make a drop more money. That sucks. And by the way, that's exactly what they did to Numbers, Pages, and Keynote. And screw them for that. I'm so annoyed at what they did to those apps.
No argument. I think the one thing that I will say with regard to that's leadership, I agree. However, if we think about the situation with Apple when Steve came back, like, they were on death's door, or at least so I've understood. I mean, I wasn't around for this. I wasn't an Apple person for this. But
90
days
from bankruptcy, they say.
Yeah, exactly. So, of course, Steve came in and, you know, destroyed everything and turned everything upside down. Not only was he one of the founders, and that kind of gave him the clout to do it, but what else are they going to do?
He did that when they were successful, too. I mean, the iPod Mini and getting killed for the iPod Nano, even though it was their most successful iPod. He was killing the successes that were helping them come back from where they were. Like, he was not afraid to do what he thought was right. Like, that's what I'm saying. It's leadership. Like, you can, Tim Cook would not make that choice and would make a very different, very strong argument to keep selling the iPod Mini because it's the most popular iPod they ever made and just sell the Nano to the people who want that one. And Steve Jobs is like, no, Nano's better. Kill the iPod Mini.
And I get that. All I'm saying is, yes, it is leadership, but I think that in a lot of ways, Steve was set up for success, set up for doing the things that had to be done because clearly whatever was going on wasn't working. Whereas right now, whoever takes over, be that Turnus or whoever else, they're entering the cockpit of a rocket ship. And to slow that rocket ship down, even though I concur that it's relatively not a lot of money, that's still a tougher, it's a tougher, bigger ask.
Yeah, they would argue is like, oh, it's not going to lose us that much money, but our share price is going to go down, so our market cap is going to lose $10 billion or whatever. And Steve Jobs would say, so what? Like, it'll be fine. But like I said, it's not just when things are going bad. The iPod Mini was going great. That was a number that was going up. And that was a case where you're making a decision that people would say you're risking the rocket ship by making that change. But Steve Jobs wanted what he wanted, and most of his decisions were right in that direction. So anyway, we'll see what happens. I'm not sure this trend line is going to change at all, because I see no deviation or even acknowledgement that everything we're talking about is even a thing when Apple executives talk. Like, do you even see them acknowledging this? Like I said, with Turnus and Jobs saying, and of course, Macs aren't junked up with anything. I'm like, well, they are now. They're like, they don't see it. If they do say it, they're not voicing it in any way. So it's really difficult to expect a different decision when there is not even any public acknowledgement that this issue exists, let alone where Apple is on the spectrum. So,
yep. All right. That was our unhappy topic. And now let's move on to maybe an unhappy topic. We'll see how this goes. Let's talk about AI generated art. And Emma Roth again, The Verge. Emma Roth in The Verge on March 2nd writes, the U.S. Supreme Court has declined to hear a case over whether AI-generated art can obtain copyright. The decision comes after Stephen Thaler, a computer scientist from Missouri, appealed a court's decision to uphold a ruling that found AI-generated art can't be copyrighted. In 2019, the U.S. Copyright Office rejected Thaler's request to copyright an image called A Recent Entrance to Paradise on behalf of an algorithm he created. The Copyright Office reviewed that decision in 2022 and determined that the image doesn't include, quote, human authorship, quote, disqualifying it from copyright protection. After Thaler appealed the decision, the U.S. District Court Judge Beryl A. Howell ruled in 2023 that, quote, human authorship is a bedrock requirement of copyright, quote. That ruling was later upheld in 2025 by a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. Last year, the Copyright Office issued new guidance that says AI-generated artwork based on text prompts isn't protected by copyright. The U.S. Federal Circuit Court similarly determined that AI systems can't patent inventions because they aren't human, which the U.S. Patent Office reaffirmed in 2024, with new guidance stating that while AI systems can't be listed as inventors on a patent, people can still use AI-powered tools to develop them. The U.K. Supreme Court made a similar determination in a case brought forward by the same fellow.
So this is a background on just establishing what at least U.S. law has been saying about copyright and AI art and a few other things, because the actual topic here is AI-generated code and copyright. And when I put this in the notes, which was a while ago at this point, lots of people online were stating flat out as a fact that, hey, don't you know, because of the Supreme Court decision in the U.S., any code you're generating with these coding agents, this is back when coding agents were just sort of becoming popular, so, you know, a little while ago now, any code you're generating with those coding agents is not copyrightable. Therefore, you don't, there's no ownership or protection or copyright protection for the code that you're doing for this. So if you are coding with one of these agents and you're putting that code into your product, what was previously copyrighted code that you owned is no longer is, because you can't copyright AI-generated stuff. Here's what the Supreme Court says. And most of the time, people just let that exist as a thing that people say, and they'd be, I didn't know that. I didn't know you can't copyright AI-generated code. But I'm not a lawyer or a judge, but my understanding from reading all these stories is this has yet to be adjudicated. I know this doesn't help, but so like so many things having to do with LLMs and AI stuff, it's an open question. The Supreme Court has ruled on AI-generated art, but I wouldn't just simply assume that because they made a decision about AI-generated art and patents, that same decision exactly applies as is to AI-generated code. Because historically, art and code and patents and things like that have all been treated differently by the courts. So as far as I'm aware, this is yet another thing involving AI that is like, I don't know. It's probably fine. Maybe not. I don't know. What do you think? But like, it hasn't been decided yet. I haven't even heard any cases coming up about this to, you know, someone claiming that, hey, because you used AI to generate that code, it's not copyrighted, therefore you don't own it, therefore blah, 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 blah. hasn't even come up yet. I'm sure it will. It will come up, just like we have all those cases about, you know, from the New York Times and Disney and all these other companies suing the people, suing ChatGPT and Anthropic and all these other companies for, like, passages from their books appearing in output. Like, that's already happening. Like, the copyright, you know, LLMs being trained and trained. But this particular frontier, like, I feel like coding agents have not been around and in wide use long enough for these big famous lawsuits from big giant companies to appear. But what I will say is, human nature being what it is, and I know this is awful and doesn't sound good, and very many things in our legal system are, you know, are this way, but human nature being what it is, and the power structures of the world being what they are, as in governments and rich people and rich companies have lots of power and other people don't, the more big, powerful entities use AI-generated code in their products, the more likely it is that it will magically be deemed to be okay and 100% legal by the courts. Because everything in the system is, like, there is, for your phrase that you were reaching for before, Casey, well, the genie's out of the bottle. These big, powerful companies want it to be okay. And if there had been a court case early on, maybe it could have gone either way. But I feel like now, no matter what happens, and I'm not saying this is even the right decision, I'm just saying this seems like it's going to be what happens, because so many people are generating so much code with coding agents that it will be very difficult for any court to decide and then be able to enforce the concept that AI-generated code is not copyrightable in any way. Because how do you even disentangle it from all the human-written code that it's mixed in with? How do you decide what has been AI-assisted, like the patent cases, versus totally AI-generated? How do you decide what human authorship is for code, depending on how long and complicated the prompt is? And it's incredibly, but, like, simple human nature. It's like the if it looks right, it flies right BS that I've talked about before about Lockheed planes and stuff. It's like big, powerful companies have been doing it too long. And every day that passes makes it much more likely that this potentially unjust and unjustifiable and unjustified decision will become fact and reality, because it's just the easiest thing to do. The big, powerful companies want it. It's too late now. Oh, well. And again, I'm not saying that's what I agree with, but that's how I feel whenever I see this topic come up. And everyone who says, AI-generated code is not copyrightable, you're all doomed if you do this in your apps. I'm like, maybe, but probably not.
All right, so with that in mind, can coding agents re-license open source through a clean room, quote-unquote, implementation of code? Question mark? Simon Wilson writes, Chardet, a Python character encoding detector, was created by Mark Pilgrim back in 2006 and released under the LGPL, or New Lesser General Public License. Mark retired from public internet life in 2011, and Chardet's maintenance was taken over by others, most notably Dan Blanchard, who has been responsible for every release since 1.1 in July 2012. 2 days ago, which was, I think, in early March, Dan released Chardet 7.0.0 with the following note in the release notes. Ground up MIT licensed rewrite of Chardet. Same package name, same public API, drop-in replacement for Chardet 5.x or 6.x. Just way faster and more accurate. Yesterday, Mark Pilgrim opened issue 327, No Right to Relicense This Project, in which he writes, first off, I would like to thank the current maintainers and everyone who has contributed to and improved this project over the years. Truly a free software success story. However, it has been brought to my attention that in the release of 7.0.0, the maintainers claim to have the right to, quote, relicense, quote, the project. They have no such right. Doing so is an explicit violation of the LGPL. License code, when modified, must be released under the same LGPL license. Their claim that it is a complete rewrite is irrelevant, since they had ample exposure to the originally licensed code, i.e., this is not a clean room implementation. Adding a fancy code generator into the mix does not somehow grant them any additional rights.
So among all the ways that AI and LLMs have the potential to destroy open source, here's a new innovation in that area, which is, hey, what if I take an open source project and I point an LLM at it and say, see this? This is an existing project written in whatever language. It's got a test suite. It's got a spec. It's got documentation. Can you write me a new version of that? Maybe you say to do it in a different language. Maybe you say to do it in a new version of the language. Maybe you just say, just do it in the same language, or just say, here's an existing thing. I want another implementation of that. and no lines of code are shared. It writes entirely new code that passes all the test suite and the other thing or whatever, and like that one was GPL licensed, now you make it MIT licensed. GPL tends to be more restrictive of what you can do with it. MIT tends to be more laissez-faire, giving people more rights or whatever, and they're like, done and done. I generated with my code generator this code, which is totally copyrightable, as far as I'm concerned, right? I have the copyright to this code, and no code is shared with the old one. Don't worry about that. That was LGPL, GPL. Nope, the new one is MIT licensed. And in fact, I'm just going, this is the new version of that old project. So now there's a new project also called Chardet with a new version number that has a different license. It doesn't share a single line of the code with the old one. It is a quote-unquote clean room re-implementation, and I'm done. And everyone in open source is like, wait, what? Like, is that that's not a thing, is it? And they start arguing based on the only precedents they have, which is like when they talk about clean room re-implementation, it's the most famous one in our industry is, I believe it was Compaq, whoever made the first IBM PC clone. This is a great story if you ever want to read about old people doing computer stuff. IBM made the original IBM PC personal computer, and it worked a particular way. And a company wanted to make a computer that could run all the same software as the IBM PC. So they set up a team and said, we are going to isolate you, and we are going to give you a spec of how the thing you should build should work. And that spec is basically like, how does the IBM PC work? But you're not going to see an IBM PC. We're not going to give you an IBM PC. You're not going to look at an IBM PC. You're not going to look at any IBM documentation. We're just going to say, please build this thing. And you, even though we know what an IBM PC is and are looking at it right now, you aren't. You're just given a spec, and you create a thing that conforms to a spec. And when you're done, you have a PC clone that can run IBM PC software, but you've never even seen an IBM PC. You didn't read their manual. You didn't look at their documentation. You don't have the chips in front of you to test or whatever. You've now cloned the PC in a quote-unquote clean room re-implementation, and it's clean because the people who made it didn't have any knowledge of the thing that they were making, you know what I mean? And that held up in court, and that's why the IBM PC clone exists. That's why we weren't using IBM computers. That's why the whole Wintel duopoly happened. It's a whole big thing. But anyway, that particular thing legally held muster in court. So, yep, you just made a thing according to a spec, and you didn't copy any of their stuff, and This is the precedent that people are citing for, hey, I pointed my LLM at an open source project and said, write that, but over here. And it did it. And lo and behold, it passes all the tests, and now it's all a clean room implementation. That's what the argument about is in Mark Barrowman coming out of internet retirement and saying, this is not clean room. First of all, the people who were prompting the LLM were the previous maintainer of this project, so they've been exposed to the code constantly. And second of all, as many people pointed out in the very long argument thread in this GitHub issue that I invite you to look at if you want to see it, people are like, but, you know, but the LLM got to see all of the source code. And I was like, well, what if the LLM just saw the test suite? And they're like, well, the test suite is part of the source code, too. What if I just described the project to it and I made sure the LLM couldn't see that? It's like, but you can't control what an LLM sees by just telling it not to do stuff, because you don't know what it's doing under the covers, and on and on and on they go. I don't know how this is going to end up. In open source, these things tend not to go to court because nobody has any money, unless like Red Hat's involved or something, right? But culturally speaking, this is like not in keeping with good behavior within the community, I would say. Most people agree. Some people are excited by it because they're like, great, now I can go LLM re-implement everything. But other people are like, you know, existing implementations have been debugged over the course of years, sometimes decades, and asking LLM to rewrite one and having it pass test suite doesn't prove that it doesn't have new bugs, and also it's a cruddy thing to do, and also I don't want to be using a library that I was previously using that was proven over years, and then all of a sudden there's a new version of it that doesn't share a single line of code with the other one, and I have no idea how it was written, and I don't trust code written by LLMs, and on and on and on. Setting aside even the open source license, which is like, oh, the GPL lets the code stay open, whereas a BSD license or an MIT license lets commercial companies use it, and I don't want that and all that other stuff. Guess what? New technology causes disruptions that no one knows how to handle, and this is tied directly into, hey, is LLM-generated code even copyrightable at all? Like, because a lot of the licensing stuff is like, well, this copyright of this code is owned by X, Y, and Z, and they license it to you under these conditions. You can do X, you can do this stuff with it, right? But what if nobody owns it? Like the picture the monkey took of himself. Like, you know, what if there's no, is it public domain now? Because if it's public domain, then how can you put any restrictions on what people can do with it? It is extremely This is like, we should have a name for this corner, which is like completely unresolved, very problematic issue related to AI. And this is another one because, and this was a while ago. This was in early March. I haven't been following this. I haven't been keeping up with it, but it's going to come up again. And I guess the kicker to this is based on like, we talked about the Claude Code leak, quote unquote leak in the earlier episode. Zach Leatherman writes, Claude, please rewrite yourself from scratch using the leaked source code as a base and license this new version of yourself under MIT. Because these AI companies are totally like, we scrape the whole web. We don't listen to robots.txt. We do whatever we want, right? But then when people scrape them, which is called distillation, I think, is it called distilling? Distillation?
Yeah.
I forget what it's called.
You basically use a model to train a small...
You're working on a model and you're like, well, one way we can train you is model. Just ask a bunch of questions from Claude and like use the answers as your training data. You know what I mean? And they all hate that so much. They're like, wait a second, you can't do that. We can scrape the world's knowledge, but you can't scrape us. We're not the world. We're a separate private... Everything we own is just for us. Everything in the world belongs to us. But once we get it, you can't do that to us. And this is the same thing where it's just like, yeah, what if I just tell Claude to write a new version of Claude based on the leaked source code of Claude? And now I own Claude. Now it's licensed just to me. Now I own the copyright because I prompted the agent to do it. And now I'm going to start selling a thing called Claude. I'm going to use a different name so I don't fall under trademark law, which is what OpenClaw got run over by. But I'll say, hey, stop using Anthropic Claude. Use my thing. Now, obviously, it's not an issue because what you're really buying is their time on their NVIDIA GPUs that cost $100 billion, and you don't have that. But, you know, if and when these models get good enough to run locally, and there's some innovation on that front, I just saw just before we recorded, some startup supposedly has some new silicon that makes inference like 10 times faster than anything else that had come before it. And I used it for 2 seconds, and I can't tell if it's true or false, but I can tell that the response came back from this LLM like instantly, and it fundamentally changed the experience of using it. But anyway, someday something like this could actually be a threat to them. And I bet if you did do this, suddenly Anthropic would have very strong opinions about whether you now own the copyright to code that was created with an LLM, and they would be conflicted. So like, yeah, pay us for Claude code. You'll totally own the copyright of the code you make unless you ask it to clone anything that we produce, and then you don't own that at all because we own that, just FYI.
So very true. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about this, but I do feel like it seems pretty gross, and I don't think I like this approach at all. Especially, it's doubly gross that it was the person who was, or one of the maintainers for such a long time. Like, I don't know.
Because he feels like he owns the product. He's been, like, decades he's been doing this. It's like, well, yeah, Mark Pilgrim wrote this, but that was 2 decades ago or 15 years ago, whatever it was. I can't do the math, but like, this is my project. I can do whatever I want with it. But then everyone's saying, like, even if that was true, which it's probably not, but even if it were true, it's a betrayal of your users. Like, they were using a thing that they trusted for reasons they thought they understood, and now every single line of it is replaced with entirely new code, which is AI generated, which is itself fraud, and yep. There's a different license.
That's not good.
Yeah, that's just
not good, Bob.
Like setting aside the legalities, this is like, as they would say back in the day, a party foul. Like you have broken the social norms. You have done something that the crowd you are walking in does not accept as good behavior, even if it turns out to be legal. But the legal questions are also just a gigantic can of worms, like regardless of how the is LLM code copyrightable or not thing turns out. And that's gotta get to the courts eventually, because the uncertainty is also something that the rich and powerful companies don't like. They want some kind of certainty. And so I think that issue will get forced sooner rather than later. But it's a complicated issue. It's not obvious what the right thing to do is. Like, all these things people talk about, I bet as a listener, you would feel more comfortable if we all could tell you this is exactly how it should be. But I personally, I don't actually know. Like, I don't know what the right call is. I think they made the right call on copyrightable art. I think that one is more cut and dried because it's the human creation of it is so tied up in it. But code, I don't know. I could have told, like, I agreed with the decision on the Oracle, like Java Oracle, like re-implementing Java, like that APIs aren't copyrightable. I agree with that decision that you should be able to just look at the API and write your own implementation. That's fine. But this one, I don't know what the right answer is. Like, I do know that it's a crappy thing to do in this context, but I don't know about the legality.
Hello, Future Marco. We can do some Ask ATP. I'm like fine tiredness-wise,
but we're done.
Okay, I just want to make sure. All right, in that case, please carry on, Marco.
Wait, but we're done with the main show?
Unless you want, we can do an Ask ATP if you want, but I felt
like only 123 in. It's a little thin.
All right, well, there's definitely a good first Ask ATP. We do one Ask ATP, and then
I think
maybe we can do the top two Ask ATP.
Yeah, I'm going
to how low Marco goes in the second one. If he can contain himself to not take a half an hour on the second question,
I promise.
We can do two.
Fingers crossed. Wait, that's the bad one, right? No, fingers not crossed.
Jesus.
Just trying to be concise. Year of efficiency.
All right.
Year of efficiency. There you go. All right. Let's do some Ask ATP. And Jason writes, when Marco was doing his long walks while wearing two fitness watches, was there any difference in the measurements? For example, does the heart rate monitoring look the same? Are there differences in the estimated calories used up? What about distance? I know both have GPS tracking, but do they both record the same distance?
Yes, there are differences. And no, they did not record the same of everything. So wearing the two watches, it's very similar. Like if you've ever changed Apple Watches, sometimes your calorie counts will be somewhat far off on the new one, and it seems like calorie estimation is just that. It's an estimation. I believe the way calorie counting usually works on fitness watches is they basically extrapolate for like the heart rate and the your body measurements, like, you know, your body weight and height, your age and the heart rate and maybe the type of activity. And they extrapolate based on that how many calories you are probably burning based on your heart rate in that scenario. I think. I could be wrong about that, but I think that's roughly what they're doing. And the thing is, there's a bunch of estimations involved there. And so any of that data that's different between different watches, or any of those assumptions that are like weighted differently or based on different modeling, will result in different calories being reported. Generally speaking, the calorie counts reported by smartwatches should basically be considered an approximation of the effort you expended relative to other similar workouts that you've done on the same watch. So, like when I do my three times a week trainer workouts, the calorie counts there give me a rough approximation of like, yeah, this was a hard one, or this was a less intense one based on, you know, what I've seen from other workouts with that same watch of that same type. But the calorie counts between the Suunto and the Garmin and the Apple Watch Ultra and regular Apple Watches, they're all different from each other. So the calorie counts themselves, those are not absolutes. They're all estimates. And again, they should only be used in terms of relative comparison between themselves doing the same kinds of activities. For GPS, that's a little bit different. GPS has a real answer. And so you can kind of, there's more of a quality judgment there. And there is kind of a truth to be found there. What I have seen is that every smartwatch and phone, for that matter, reports GPS a little bit differently. And the main reason, I think, based on what I know about GPS and what I've learned so far, GPS, if it's inaccurate, if you have like a little bit of a signal weakness, or, you know, the antennas pick up like a reflection of a signal off a building instead of the direct signal, what you tend to get with that is kind of a wobble. You'll have GPS that seems like maybe you're like, it'll look on the map kind of like you're zigzagging back and forth within the path more than you really did, or if it's like city streets, it'll show you crossing the street sometimes when you really didn't cross the street. And part of the reason why I like dual band GPS watches, which in the Apple world is just the Apple Watch Ultra, but in you know, the other fitness watches world, they have many more models with dual band GPS. Part of the reason why dual band GPS is better is that they use both bands to try to figure out like what was the more likely path this person actually took. Because if there's like a problem, or if there's a weakness or a reflection with the signal from one of the bands, odds are the other one won't have it quite the same way, and so they can kind of like average them out, or try to filter them in clever ways. But GPS data is something that needs filtering to really make it make sense. Like sometimes if you have like a bad reading, it could show it as being 100 feet away or something, or 10 feet away or something. And so different watches will also not only have different, you know, antennas and things to pick up the signals, but they'll also have different algorithms for how they're filtering that data. And even within the Apple Watch, you'll have different apps that have different filtering algorithms, because the Apple Watch delivers you what it thinks is, you know, accurate GPS data, but it also has wobbles and imprecision built into certain signals that come in. And different apps will sample them differently and will filter them differently. So GPS is also an approximation, but what I have seen is the Suunto watch so far seems to underreport distance compared to the Apple Watch Ultra by about 5 to 10%. Now with GPS, if you're thinking about like that wobble effect, if you're walking in a straight line and your GPS points kind of show you wobbling left and right a little bit, then the wobbled data set is going to be a little bit longer distance because you're burning up some fake distance with those fake wobbles. What I tend to think is that with GPS measurements on smartwatches, I think the shortest measured distance is probably the more accurate one. And in this case, so far, what I'm seeing every time is that the Suunto is a little bit shorter than the Apple Watch Ultra. So I think the Suunto is a little bit more accurate based on
my experience with my dog's GPS is the opposite of that, where when signal gets crappy or has some kind of interference, the line on like where did you walk your dog will suddenly have this perfectly straight segment, and I know that segment is wrong. Like there was wobble, the path does wind, but it was like, well, we had bad signal, we got you here, we got you there, it's 2 points we connect him with a line. So that's the other case of like it could be you're getting shorter measurements because you should check on Pedometer Plus to see. Well, I guess you can't, but like it would be good to see the actual data, because if you see wobbly line versus straight line and there's the same number of points, fine. But if you see wobbly line versus straight line and the straight one only has 2 points, not more accurate.
Yeah, and that's probably a smoothing artifact. That's probably like if the path was actually shaped wobbly, and you know, it's possible that the algorithm that was taking those measurements might have thought this was probably really a straight line. And so
or maybe
they
didn't have
it.
More than two data points. Like maybe they couldn't get satellite signal right. for these 10 feet, and now that's all they've got is this point and that point, and what can they do? They got to connect them with a line.
Yeah, that's also very possible, because like you know with GPS, like you have a certain amount of precision with the signal, and like the weaker or more kind of dirty or unreliable the signal is, the less certainty the radios can derive about your actual location. You know, it's also possible that like between different points, the kind of circle of doubt around your location, where like they think you're somewhere in here, but their precision has temporarily decreased because of conditions, like that can also cause the same kind of wobble. So it's an imprecise thing. Again, kind of like calorie counting, like it's more of an estimate, but GPS is much more precise than calorie counting.
Well, you know the solution. Underscore would tell you more watches.
Yeah, so
far. Just slapping them on there. Just average them all together.
All right, and then Stephen Goza writes, what's the difference between Marco putting all of his Mac Mini servers in a data center versus just putting them in his home? Business class fiber service has no data caps, so the data center doesn't really have anything over regular business fiber. You can have backup electricity at home, so it's not about the data center power. Based on Marco's story, it doesn't seem like the people in the data center will physically help him. Like if he needs to restart a machine, they're not going to walk down the aisle and push the button for him. So what makes a data center hosting more professional than just hosting them at home?
Great question. And for a while, I was hosting them at home, and so I can tell you exactly the difference. So what Stephen says is correct, that most residential fiber services, like you know Verizon Fios I have here, most residential fiber ISPs prohibit running servers. Now, what does that mean? That's a very vague thing. Generally, I think what they mean by that is using a lot of upstream bandwidth to serve live traffic from people making requests inbound to your IP address for some kind of open port that you run services off of. In practice, that's going to be really hard to enforce, and I've never heard of it actually being enforced against anybody, but that is officially against their terms of service to run servers like that. And sometimes the way they will do this is things like data caps or, you know, if you're using like a sustained perfect amount of data all the time, like they might notice that and they might have a problem with that. But these days, like, there's a few things that I think wouldn't have triggered this for me. One is that the usage pattern of these particular servers running transcripts are mostly downloading data. They download a bunch of data and they upload a little bit of data because they download the MP3s and listen to them and transcribe them, and they upload the transcripts, which are mostly text, so they're small. That usage pattern looks like residential usage. And if you have a whole bunch of residential downstream and a little bit of upstream all the time, that kind of just looks like somebody is running Netflix on the TV. So I don't think that would really, you know, flag a bunch of attention to it. Now, the question is, what if you just get business internet service? You can get a business fiber line. I have one at the restaurant. The main reason why not to do that is business internet service is just much more expensive for the exact same service. Like, that's, it's the standard kind of enterprise pricing model. It's like, oh, you're a business slash wedding, you know, whatever it is, these keywords that make things more expensive.
Business, baby?
Yeah, exactly. Business is one of those. And so business internet service costs 2 to 3 times as much in most places for the same amount of bandwidth. Also, usually the amount of bandwidth available might be lower. And in my case, the restaurant Fios, I believe, costs about 2.5 times the price of my residential Fios at the same speed, which is 1 gigabit. So it costs more. But that being said, you know, if I wanted to run this like on the up and up, I could do business internet. There is the question, though, of redundancy. So a data center, like, they have redundancy built in. They usually have multiple internet connections from multiple providers, possibly on multiple physical routes. So, like, you know, if a line gets cut somewhere, like, the entire data center isn't just out of luck for a while. So that's certainly a big advantage there on the internet service. Now, let's talk about power. At a restaurant, having redundant power, having, like, a big backup generator or something, actually, in New York, does not make a lot of sense because, as I learned from my health code class, you are required to close if you lose power from the utility company. So,
for any amount of time, like even if it's just a hiccup?
If it's like a brief blip, that's fine. But like if you have like a total power outage and, you know, your fridges aren't running, you're, you know, like whatever it is, like if you have like a sustained power outage, you are required to close the restaurant and, you know, have all the customers leave.
Yeah, but like a Generac or whatever would like make that not an issue, right?
Technically, you are correct, but it is against the rules. The health code rules are if you lose utility power, you must close the restaurant.
And you can see why they would have that.
Yeah, totally.
Like, well, you know, I have a generator, so I don't have to worry about this. But of course, the generator doesn't run the whole restaurant, just the essential things. And what I decide is essential is perfectly fine. And so there's no chance of foodborne illness because I decided one thing wasn't actually essential when it turns out it was. Like, the law is a lot easier to just say, look, you lose power. Tough luck. Maybe they'll have to update it someday when every place has their own solar panels powering them. But for now, I understand this law entirely.
Yeah, like that's it. Yeah, you can exactly see why. Because it's like, well, are all your walk-in fridges and stuff on that? Like, you know, what about emergency things? Like, you know, are your bathroom exit signs? Like, you know, there's tons of stuff where, like, if, you know, if a restaurant just has power to a few key things, that might not necessarily be enough for the health department. So there is actually a pretty strong incentive for restaurants not to have much redundant power. I, of course, have like UPSs on my network equipment, just, you know, for brief blips to not disrupt things. But, you know, that's so there's not redundant power at most restaurants for good reasons, at least not long running redundant power. Data centers have tons of redundant power. That's kind of the whole thing. Like, they have a huge, ridiculous setup of like 2 different power sources, two different sets of generators and backups and all these different, you know, switching and all these different things. It's, you know, it's made for that. That's what they're designed for. So in practice, the odds of an outage affecting servers I'm running in my house is far higher than the odds of an outage affecting a data center. And especially for that outage lasting, you know, more than a minute or two, odds are much, much better at a data center that you're going to stay online. There is the question of the amounts of power and bandwidth needed. Now, I know from setting up groups of 6 Mac Minis in my house as I was like setting up the computer before I bring them to the data centers, I know that my total usage for the 48 Mac Minis, if I ran them all in my house, would need about 1.6 gigabits per second sustained all the time down. That is more than I can get in a home connection. I don't think I have anything above a gigabit available to me right now. So 1.6 gigabits sustained would be the 48 Mac Minis downstream when they're at full load. Also, they would use about 2,000 watts, which, like, I could do that in my house. It's kind of ridiculous. and it's not without cost, but I could do that in my house. But that is a pretty large amount of internet bandwidth and power to be running out of your house, even on a business connection. That's kind of a lot. Then also, there is the the heat and the cooling and just the amount of physical space they need. Like, yeah, they're small, but, you know, my house is not that big that I have a room I could devote to, like, a full-height rack to run a bunch of Mac Minis in. Like that.
And normally, if they weren't Mac Minis, there would also be the noise. I know that's not probably not an issue for the Mac Minis, but for basically anything that's not a Mac Mini, noise becomes a factor pretty quickly.
Yeah, and so you start, you know, you have all this space, you have all the heat, you have the bandwidth from your business Fios connection that is going to be used. Like, you know, if I had a business Fios connection to run these on, I would probably also want a separate residential connection to run the rest of my personal stuff on, because that it would take up the whole connection. So once you start adding up these costs, you're talking hundreds of dollars, probably, for a 2 gigabit connection business-wise, fiber-wise, you're probably talking about $500 a month. Then you're talking about, you know, 2,000 watts all the time of power consumption. That's a few hundred bucks probably. And so you're looking at, like, you know, $500, $600, $700, $800 just for the. And by the way, that's going to, you know, that 2,000 watts, that's like, you know, roughly 1.5 space heaters worth of heat that, you know, in the summertime, you have to cool that. So you're also going to be spending more energy cooling that heat, at, you know, out of whatever room it's in. So you start getting into hundreds of dollars per month and, you know, almost maybe, you know, almost $1,000 a month. It's like, well, then you could just get the data center for that. And then finally, in terms of, you know, Steven said, it sounds like the people in the data center will not physically help me if something needs to be rebooted. That's actually not true. They have a service called Remote Hands. I think most data centers have something like this where I can pay some hourly rate that I can have them go like and talk them through doing stuff to my rack and they will do it for me. It is, I think it's like, you know, $100 or $200 an hour. So like, it's not something that I would want to do willy-nilly, but if I really needed something, I could call them and have them go do something for me. So all of that, that's why data center hosting makes sense, because you could do all these things at home. Some of them would be significantly less fault tolerant if they were in your home. And ultimately, the economics of doing things, once you have more than a couple of these, it starts to not make sense to do it at home.
You left off your most important point, which is so kind of the opposite of your, it's not my fault, it's not my fault, but it is my problem. Well, if something goes wrong, if you were hosting this in your house and something went wrong with your like redundant power supplying or something went wrong with your internet connection, you have to fix that.
Yeah.
Because it's you're running the quote unquote data center out of your house. Now, if it's in the data center, it's still your problem, but you physically can't fix it. You don't own the data center. You can't fix that problem. So at the very least, you have the relief of knowing, well, there's nothing I can do about it. It sucks, and it is my problem, and not that it really matters that much for transcription, because it's not like it's a live service the customers are using, but like the relief of knowing I can't fix the power or cooling problem to the data center, they have to fix that. And if they turn out to be really bad at fixing that, you could go to another data center in theory, because in theory it's a competitive business. Whereas if you're hosting it in your house, guess what? Now you've got another job.
Yeah, like what if I'm like on vacation? And do I have to like call one of my neighbors and say, hey, can you please come to my house?
Pay them $200 an hour to be a remote hand.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
and go into your house and don't go into the other rooms, just into the one room that has the Mac Minis in it.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Thank you to our sponsors this episode, Quince, Zapier, and Lisa. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about expansion for Macs in a world without the Mac Pro. What does that look like? What are our options here? We'll talk about that in Overtime. You can join to listen to hear it, atp.fm/join. Thank you so much, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, I bought myself a toy a couple of weeks ago.
Is it a Mac Pro?
No. Goodness no. Well, who would ever buy a Mac Pro deliberately, right, John?
I would buy one if the price was right.
No, I bought myself a GL iNet toy. So GL iNet does a lot of things. If you know them, you probably know them for their travel routers, which I still have one in the tailgate tub. I have a different one that that I'm using occasionally when I travel, in addition to the UTR, the Unified Travel Router, depending on the situation. But this is not a router at all. This is something different. What this is a PoE powered KVM. So What I realized when I was doing the work on rebuilding the NUC that was previously my channel server in Connecticut and then became the host of all my Docker containers, among other things, and I put Proxmox on it. What I realized when I started that process was I need a physical screen and I need a physical keyboard and a physical mouse. All of these things I have, I have them in the house. I have a travel monitor that I use, you know, when I go and work remotely, which is typically most Wednesday mornings. I do that because it's much easier to study for ATP than it is to write code on, you know, a 13-inch Mac or 14-inch MacBook Pro and a like 10 or 12-inch accessory monitor. And I have that, but it's either USB-C or either mini or micro HDMI, whatever the small one is. I always get it backwards. And I have a like full size to micro cable or whatever it is, but that's like a pain in the butt because then I got to go get it. And I usually know where it is, but I got to find it in the pile of cables and then you got to get it. And then you got to power the display. If you're not powering it over, you know, USB-C, if it's not data and power in one, then you got to power it as well. And then I have an old, actually, I think from my iMac Pro, I have my keyboard and trackpad from that. And so I can get those out, but then I need a couple of lightning cables, and I'm starting to run low on those, actually, because there's almost no devices that I use in my life that still need them. And it's just kind of annoying and burdensome. Granted, first world problem, for sure, but burdensome nonetheless. Now, my friend Alex from Tailscale, past sponsor, I think future sponsor, if I'm not mistaken, on the Tailscale YouTube channel, he had pointed out that GLINET makes the Comet PoE, which is our Comet PoE remote KVM control. So what this is a little box, and it has, you know, an Ethernet jack, a USB-C, two USB-C ports, an HDMI port, and a USB-A port. And what you do is you plug in either USB-C for power, or if you have PoE available, power over Ethernet available, which I do, then you just plug in an Ethernet cable that gives you power and network connectivity. You have a USB-C cable that they provide that can go into USB-A, or that does go to USB-A, and that provides both keyboard and mouse across one cable. And then you connect HDMI from the device into this box, and you can optionally add some sort of like external disk drive on the USB-A port. But what this does is it gives me network attached, quote unquote, physical access to a computer, because as far as the computer that I'm using is concerned, this is a physical monitor. It's a physical keyboard. It's a physical mouse. It's just that this fancy little box happens to be beaming it across the internet. And the reason I saw it on the Tailscale YouTube channel is because it will natively jump on your tailnet, which is super freaking cool. So what that means is I have a couple of screenshots that I will share both in the chat and in the show notes and everywhere else. But here's a screenshot of me using the Proxmox NUC from this GLINET thing. And you can see that I just went to a URL on my tailnet, and I have a terminal window where I whiffed the password a couple times, but that's neither here nor there. But anyways, I have a terminal window, and so that's pretty cool. But it's not just for Linux machines. If you want, you can connect it to, I don't know, a Mac. And so here's another screenshot of me using it with my Mac Mini that runs Plex and Jellyfin and Channels. And so this is a really silly little contraption that, generally speaking, will live in a box. But on the occasions I need to connect physically to something, this is going to be so much nicer and so much easier than dragging out several, you know, 17 different cables. I'm being hyperbolic, but, you know, 17 cables, a monitor power, that one random micro or mini or whatever HDMI to full-size HDMI cable. It's all just in this one little box, and then I use it from whatever computer I want. I could use it from an iPad if I wanted, and it's great. And if I wanted to install software on whatever this is connected to, I can, upload an ISO to the KVM and have the ISO masquerade as a USB key connected to the device, you know, to the computer. I've never tried this, but I believe that to be the case. So I don't know. There's not much to be said here other than that. I'm happy to answer questions if you have any, but it's just, this is one of those neat little things that, did I need it? Absolutely not. And it happened to be on sale, whatever that sale was a couple of weeks ago on Amazon. I forget what specifically it was, but
they're always inventing something.
Yeah, they're always inventing some reason to have a sale. And so it was a little under $100. And I think this is a device that should cost a little under $100. And it's really neat to have. and I really like it. And Marco, if you had the need to have quote unquote physical access to only one of your 48 Mac minis, I highly suggest this thing. I would not necessarily put this on all 48 of them, but if you had one that was like a controller or something for all the others, this would be a really great way to have, what did you call it? Like remote hands or whatever, your helping hands. This would be a pretty good way to do it because again, as far as the physical computer is concerned, this is a physical keyboard, a physical mouse and a physical monitor. It just so happens that they're not those things and they're actually all being presented on the internet.
That's pretty cool. I can actually see, like, I actually might at some point get one of these to, like, right now the way my servers are set up, there is no one controlling server. Like, they all are peers and they all just connect to the web service and get jobs and work on them and submit them back to the web service.
Cattle, and, not pets.
Right. And there are, like, and like right now, like, you know, one thing I've thought about is, should I at some point, like, put a some other kind of server in the data center, in the rack with the other ones on their network to do kind of controlling things? Like, right now, my power, the ATS, the transfer switch, my power switch thing, I have one that has remote control over the ports. So, like, right now, if I needed to reboot the Mac minis, like, one of the Mac minis, if I need to power cycle one, and I can't do it remotely via, like, you know, SSH or remote desktop, I can log into one of the other ones as long as any of them are working. I can log into one of them and open up, like, via remote desktop, open up, like, the local browser interface to the power unit and reboot the entire bank of six that whatever the problem one is plugged into.
So I, like, still have the remote hands problem of, like, you can tell me, maybe you'll discover this, or maybe a Mac admin will tell you, but I think there's still some stuff where you need to press the physical button on the Mac mini, like the enter recovery mode and stuff, and this KVM will not hold down the power button on your Mac mini for you.
I mean, that's that true. If I was to the point where I had to enter recovery mode, I would just drive to the data center and, like, pick it up, bring
remote
it back to my
hands.
House and deal it with it. But yeah, but what am I in recovery mode for?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just saying, like, when you have actual, like, data center hardware, they try to make it so that you can do everything remotely, or at the very least do everything from, like, a console in the data center. But with Macs, maybe Mac admins can correct me. It just seems to me that there's probably some remaining stuff, like, that you need to, in the Apple Silicon Age, you still need to hold down the power button physically, and a KVM can't do that. Unlike the good old days where the power button used to be on the keyboard. I'm not sure if you guys were Mac users back then, but it was cool.
I'm familiar with this as a thing, but no, I was not a Mac user then. Also, it's worth noting, Marco, that this thing does have, like, the web UI has like a little toolbox, they call it. And so this is where you can, like, paste something and then into the web UI and then tell the web UI, okay, basically type this on the remote machine, right? So it's kind of like it's a very rudimentary but functional clipboard sharing, right? Well, another thing it has is a wake on LAN section. So you can add, like, you know, MAC addresses and name them and have the KVM fire a wake on LAN packet over to whatever device you need. Is that useful for you? I don't know, but it's neat that it's a thing. I really, really like this little box. It's the sort of thing that I certainly didn't need. I used birthday money for it, so it was the perfect birthday gift. And again, like, I don't know if I would want to watch a full screen video on it. Like, I mean, using the Mac on it, it's pretty freaking quick. Well, especially when it's in the same house, but it's pretty freaking quick. But the point is, I typically plan to use this for situations where I just need to plug something into a physical screen. And this is probably going to be the most convenient way to do it, because as long as I have PoE or, you know, a USB-C input from something, even like a battery pack, as long as I have an Ethernet connection, which I have in several places in the house, this is such an easy way to get what is quote unquote physical access to a computer. And I really like it. And the fact that it's on my tailnet makes it super nice, because, you know, I was thinking in the scenario where I'm, like, going out of town on vacation or something like that, I can put this on either the Mac mini or the Proxmox box. Anyways, I can put this on one of those. And, you know, if I have some sort of issue that would typically require physical contact with the machine, I can just log into this thing and perhaps work whatever magic I wouldn't be able to otherwise. So, maybe I'm the only one who wants it. Maybe this is not appealing to anyone else. And like, you don't have to use this with TailScale, by the way. It's just nice that it's TailScale native, so you don't have to think about it. But really good stuff. And I'll put a link to an affiliate link, to be honest, in the show notes. And I'll put a link to Alex's video, which covers it in about 10 minutes. But I thought it was cool. All right, titles. All
right.
Where's my tab? Let's see.
Let's see what we got.
This particular frontier is good.
I like you can bend this line.
Yeah, I like that one too.
Yeah, frontier is good. Let me see.
I liked Nothing is Sacred Anymore, although maybe we've used that before. It feels like something we might have said in the past.
I like Now I Own Claude.
Rapid Path to Mediocrity was also good. I suggested both those last two.
That is very good, too. We got some good ones.
Yeah, those are good.
Yeah, I like Bend This Line, Frontier, and Mediocrity. And those are my top three.
Where is the Frontier one?
It's currently number three votes.
This particular Frontier.
Yeah, I like Bend. That's my favorite.
Oh, really? I don't dislike it. That was not my favorite, but you two agree, so that's going to be the case. Yeah, reference acknowledged. All right.
Have you seen the movie?
I think I did, but it was 18 million years ago, so effectively, yeah. No.
Marco, do you know that movie exists?
The Bend It Like Beckham?
Yeah.
I have heard the title of the movie.
Woo! Web Declaring Victory.
I don't think I've seen it.
What is it about?
I believe it is about a famous soccer player who could bend balls in half, and they were encouraging.
Not correct, but close enough. Like, give you partial credit.
Wasn't it what's the lady from Love Actually and Pirates, whose name is escaping me?
Keira
right
Knightley.
Now. Yes, wasn't that one of her first?
Not one of her first, but she's in it.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, goodbye, live people. Thank you for being live people. I believe we are still normal schedule for the next several weeks, so we will talk to you next week.
Yep. Bye.